Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the meeting on Pioneers in AA. Thank you for coming. My function is a pleasurable and a simple one. It is to introduce the three speakers on this topic before you now. I'm Mike Alexander, a trustee emeritus. Trustee Emeritus, that's AA speak. For those who know, it means I'm a non-alcoholic. I was once a trustee, that's once upon a time. I was also chairman of the board. And now, I don't have much to do, and AA doesn't quite know what to do with me. But I certainly am pleased to be here, despite these accommodations, which look to me like they were a staging area for the invasion of Normandy in World War II. But it's okay, since we're talking about pioneers of AA, I feel comfortable because the pioneers of AA certainly encountered Spartan conditions in their work for AA and in their meetings at AA places where they were supposed to be. When I was first elected trustee, I was told that as a non-alcoholic, I would be a Class A trustee. The alcoholic trustees were to be known as Class B trustees. I thought that was very nice. Until one of the first trustees that I met on the board, a marvelous man, Max C., was then trustee at large in Canada, took me aside, appointed himself as my mentor, because it was obvious to him that I needed a lot of attention and instruction. And he started by telling me that Class A stood for amateur. And Class B for better. I quickly became aware that there were a lot of things I had to learn about AA, and I started listening very carefully to Mac and the others who chose to instruct me, because obviously to them I needed much instruction. I'm sure it was some. I will tell you a little bit more about that, but first I'm obliged to read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any institution, politics, organizations, or institution that does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any cause. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Our first speaker today, who is my pleasure to introduce to you, is Harry V. He has been in the fellowship since 1959. He told me it was around in 1951, but he didn't quite get the hang of membership at that time. But he did. He's interested in archives, which happens to be a great interest of mine. We chatted about it. We met for the first time this morning. His home group is in Washington, the state of Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, Harry V.
We're just barely going to get enough time to say hello. My name is Harry, and I'm a wino. Okay. I have the privilege of holding this book for the last time. It's going to be staying in Philadelphia with my new friends. I give it to Michael and Anne Marie G. of Philadelphia. And this is the book that I did my first, fourth, and fifth step with. And Bill Wilson signed this book in 1965 for me. Okay. As I said, my sobriety day is November 4th, 1959. I came in and came around in 51, but just couldn't seem to get it. I was here for the wrong reason. I found out they had the women group, so I kept coming back. What an excitement to be here at the 70th anniversary. Sadly, my sponsor, who's very ill, can't be here. He mentioned and asked me, would I please give his name so he spiritually could be with you? And his name is Frank Kell, Pennsylvania. And he got sober. In 2-8-64. I have a vivid recollection of seeing Bill and Lois. I was sitting around and 7 months dry and not really all that interested, you know, but I didn't, trying not to drink again, desperately trying for the first time not to drink. So I decided I better go down there. I heard Bill was in Long Beach. It was in 1960. So I took a trip down there and I sat down there in the middle of the Friday afternoon, sitting in a room about half this size. And you see, room about half this size, and what happened was along come this guy, tall, lanky-looking guy, you know, and he had a suit on, looked like come off the Salvation Army rack. And I took a second look, and I had seen this picture, and it was Bill Wilson. And he came up to the podium. I wasn't too impressed with the way he looked. But he started to talk. And he talked about calling us, he called us the children of the night. And the chills went up and down my spine, and something magical took place. It just got to me, and something happened, and I knew that somehow, some way, I was going to have to find a way to stay sober. So I stayed there and I went back home to where I lived in El Monte, and then finally I went to 65. I have to skip over this real fast. And so 65 I went to Toronto, where we're at here today, and came up here to for the second international convention I attended. And I brought my big book with me. And a very dear friend of mine, Sybil, arranged for me to be in a room where Bill and Lois, we didn't even know Lois was going to be there, but Bill there, and she said, only stay about 5-10 minutes, that's what he does. Something magical happened in that room. These people were from all over the world. They had little homemade gifts for Bill and Lois. And he stayed, and Lois stayed for close to 2 hours. And there were only about 35 or 40 of us in the room. And it was an amazing experience. There was not a dry eye in that room, including Bill and Lois. And I left there. I flew up there to Toronto. I didn't feel I needed a plane to get home. I thought, that's how good I felt. But it was wonderful, and I got to see him. I didn't get to see Bill after that because Bill was quite ill. In 1965, well, the thing that really got to me, and they did it last night, the Scottish Highlanders, and they piped the colors as the flags went up to the stage. And this was a marvelous thing. They had done that in 65. What they did after that, I expected to see this, and of course I only stayed for part of it. I only had the chance to stay for part of it, but all of AA representatives from all over the world stepped out of a world globe and came out and joined hands. And they recited the I Am Responsible. And then Bill and Lois, hand in hand, stepped out of that stage globe, and they walked to the edge of the stage, and they said, let's all join hands. And that was the first time, and we all joined hands and said the I Am Responsible. It was just, it blew my mind, and everybody else's, I guess. Sybil had arranged for me to be Bill, and then I got that that pretty much it was sort of only give you a little highlights of what occurred there, but all I can tell you, it was such a feeling of spiritual feeling I had never experienced before. I got The book that I have here, Bill signed, I'm giving that, and I won't be taking that home with me, and it's going to stay here with Michael and Anne-Marie of Philadelphia. And it's a pleasure to give them this book after having it for all these years. I bought this book in 1955 when it came out, but I didn't read it. I left it on the shelf. You know, it was, you know, I sort of skipped through and looked at it, glanced at it, and I put it up on the shelf. And, you know, I had to continue to do some research for you people. So I stayed out there, and so it was November 4th, 1959, until I had my last drink. And I used this book for my first, as I said, for my first, fourth, and fifth step. And they were very serious on the West Coast the way they did this. And they made your boy, you really had to go through it. And they did it in the group. And you didn't even get to pick the person you're going to take it with. And I'm going to tell you a strange thing that probably you'll never hear again. But what they did, they said, Harry, you've had so much trouble with women, we're going to have you take your fifth step with a woman. And I darn near said, went out and got drunk over that. And I kept telling him, I said, she's going to run screaming down the road when she hears all this stuff. They said, no, 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 we're all cut from the same cloth. I said, you're crazy. He said, I know, but he said, that's what the way it is. Well, anyway, that's what happened. And as a result of that, it was one of the most moving experiences. I guess I really came close to my God as I began to understand him for the first time. This woman led me through, and I had an awful time breaking into some of the stuff. And finally, when I did, I just broke down and sobbed, and everything gushed out. And this woman sat there, was so very understanding. She told me things about her. And I looked at her, gee, these. So anyway, it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And her, this lady's first name was Vi. Okay. Anyway, later on, they asked me to sponsor. And so I'm sponsoring men and having sponsored somebody and sponsoring men. And a woman came along and wanted me to take her through the steps. I ran like hell for my sponsor and told him what was happening, because this woman was gorgeous, you know. And Harry still had some of his old ideas buzzing around, you know. I was having a hell of a time with it. But anyway, what I did, I told him, I said, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? He says, Harry, he says, let me tell you something. He says, nowhere do we find in our literature that God removed our natural desires. And I said, oh, he didn't? And I thought it was okay, you know. He said, but, you're going to hear a lot of buts from me sponsored. He says, that does not mean, Harry, that you act on them, you know. Oh. So that's the way it was. So I did a lot of praying that night. Oh, God, I really never prayed so much in my life. Please, God, you know, help me. And so the next day she came and stood across from the table from each other and, you know, shared. And I found it was one of the most moving experiences in my life I ever had. And then my sponsor sends me out. He says, I want you to go over to this woman's group and speak. I said, woman's group? Oh, well, okay. Small group. Okay. And I come back. He sends me out to another woman's group. What the heck is this? Send me out to women's group. He says, Harry, you had a lot of trouble with women. And you have to tell them. We've talked to them. Well, what's the matter with the men? I know how to talk to the men, too. Later, Harry. And he kept running me. And finally, one night, he sent me out. And I know there's people here who have been there. He said, there's a cancellation tonight, he says, at the Rod Radford Street group in Los Angeles. Anybody here from Los Angeles? Okay. My God, he sent me out there, and I drove into that parking lot, and the cars were parked, and I opened up that door, and I looked at, geez, a wall of wall people, and I knew it was in the wrong room. This was not the AA meeting. And somebody said, hey, Harry, come on in. And lo and behold, I was in the AA meeting, and I tried to get out, and I tried to go to the bathroom, and so I could duck out of there, and they went along with me. So I wound up on the stage like this here, and there was a woman whom I had on the top of my amends list, and her name was Polly. I can say this, she's dead now, and I had nothing to do with her demise. And she, her name was Polly Hall, and they used to assassinate her character all through AA, tell everybody what a rotten so-and-so she was. And the newcomers particularly, stay away from her. And so anyway, what happened, I got to speak here at the Radford group, and I didn't realize that sponsor knew. He knew. This was Polly Hall's home group. And I look over, she's sitting over in the front row, and I go, oh, my God. So I told my story anyway, and I come down off the stage, teary-eyed, she come over, and it was wonderful, wonderful. I had always thought this woman was the ugliest woman I ever seen in my life. And I looked at her, and she looked absolutely beautiful and radiant. And it was a marvelous, marvelous experience, and it happened, and then something happened, and she was getting a little old, you know, frail. And so she passed away about 7 weeks later. I continued on, and things that have happened to me, I'll tell you briefly because I ain't got much time. What happened to me, I was asked to go to Russia. Russia, my God. And what happened, I was talking to this guy, and I said, geez, I said, he's talking about going, I said, I'd love to go there. One of these days, I'm going to have the money, I'm going to go. He said, you got a passport? And I said, no. He says, go down and get your passport, and I'll see about getting your visa. Geez. So I got to go to Russia, and I got to speak at the 10th anniversary of AA in Kiev. And I'm speaking. The night I spoke, there's a lady interpreter because, you know, I didn't understand Russian and they didn't understand English, you know. And so this beautiful, beautiful woman is standing there and I'm around and she says, slow down. So I finally had to realize that somebody had to interpret. And so I went through that and I got through talking and I never seen anything like this in my life. These people couldn't understand how we would even come over there. And they're sitting there, and they're crying, and the tears coming, tears of joy. And it was just awesome. I met a lady here who was in the audience here, says, remember me, and I got to go to England and speak at Bristol. And that was also another moving experience. And I've had many wonderful things happen to me, miracles happen to me in AA. A guy who had never been trusted in his life, and he had a record, you know, I won't even mention, talk about. And I went to work. I was given a job at the city of Pasadena. I had the keys to the city of Pasadena. My God, and I was one of the biggest thieves you ever seen in your life. And I had the keys to the Huntington Library, and there was a very beautiful painting there I always really liked. I'm quite a nut about art. It was a picture of Gainsborough's Blue Boy, and it was only worth about $34-35 million then. But I could picture that hanging in my living room, you know, stuff like that. So anyway, didn't get to do it, but I got to it. I had the keys to the library, and I could go in and see this stuff, the Huntington Library and everything. It was beautiful. And to be given the keys, and what happened was when they took my fingerprints, I was done with. And I told the guy, and he said, no, you go up, have the lieutenant do that and have him call me. This is city manager of Pasadena. Now, I was in charge of the Rose Bowl at that time. And so I did this, and I went up there, and he got through, and he come out, and he hands me a manila envelope. And he says, take this back to city manager. It's about this thick. And took back city manager, and the city manager, Harry, he said, these are your records, your criminal records. He says, we're sealing the records. It was hard to imagine that this could possibly happen. I had the keys to the whole city. And it shows what happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. People begin to trust. And I went on, and they liked what I did, and I'm the first person to use color on the football field. I used the color on the Rose Bowl field, and that was the first time it was ever used. And from then on, people were coming in, learning how to use it. I wish I could go on and tell you many, many things. I got to go a few years ago, I think, I went to the Gathering of Eagles, and I shared with many old-timers such as Cersei and Addie. Addie H. is still alive. Cersei is gone. And Dr. Bob Smith. And I had got to eat with Smitty sitting right across the table from me, and we're laughing and kick, you know, and they're needling me about, you know, different things. And Laurie L., who was there, she was there. And a whole bunch of the old-timers were there. And I had the privilege of spending a lot of hours, you know, sitting talking to these people. And it just was beyond my comprehension. I've attended 9 international conferences. This is my 9th one, and I think there were 12, weren't there? And one of them, I couldn't tell you why I didn't go, but that was the year Bill died in 1970. And DeBill was died in 71, but he was very, very ill in 1970. And I went down later. I was asked to go down, and I talked to the man who spent an awful lot of time with Bill. And I taped a lot of stuff, which I'll have to give to the archives. I'd like to keep it, but I got to give it to the archives. Long term. And this guy told a lot of stories about Bill. This guy was broke. He came into AA. Somebody drives a Rolls Royce into his driveway, and he says, "Can you fix this?" And the guy fixed it. And he says, "We need a dealer here in Miami. You're now the exclusive Rolls Royce dealer for Rolls Royce in Miami." And this guy's a multimillionaire today. So I got to spend a lot of time when Charles had taken care of Bill when Bill was terribly ill. A lot of people don't know this. And he was terribly ill at 70. He only spoke a few minutes at the conference in Florida. And so Wesley Parrish, I can use the name, he's gone now. Wesley finished the talk. To me, Wesley is a wonderful, wonderful man who contributed so much to AA. And to me, I'm particularly just so terribly grateful to him, and I'm sure you'll too be too. He's the person who sparked the thing where we saved the birthplace of AA in Akron, Ohio. And I was real close to this man, and I've known him for a number of years. Anyway, I grew up, as I say, I got sober in the best of places in Los Angeles, and all of the wonderful icons that were in AA, and I was just a new guy in the block, and I used to get with the other new guys, and we'd circle around and empty the ashtrays, and do you want some more coffee, and stuff like that. We were trying to get up close to hear what these secrets were about AA, how you worked the program, you know. And it was hilarious. I know they must have laughed their butt off about us. But anyway, that's where I got sober with Chuck C. and Matt and all of the others that are gone now. The many wonderful, wonderful people that held AA together in its beginning years when it really needed help. I'm 89 years old. If I'd have known I was going to live this long, I'd have taken a little better care of myself. But anyway... in closing, I want to do one thing first. Wesley always used this in his closing, and I'd like to read it to you and then use what I say. It's called The Windows of Gold in the Kingdom of God. It says, there is a legend that has often been told of the boy who searched for the windows of gold. The beautiful windows he saw far away, when he looked in the valley at sunrise each day. But he lived on a mountain that was covered with snow, and he knew that it would be a difficult trek, but that was a journey he wanted to make. So he planned by day and he dreamed by night of how he would reach that great shining light. So one golden morning when the dawn had broke through and the valley below sparkled with diamonds of dew, he started to descend down the mountainside with the windows of gold as his goal and his guide. He traveled all day, weary and worn, with feet that were bleeding and clothes that were torn. He entered the peaceful valley town, just as the golden sun went down. But he seemed to have lost his guiding light, for the windows were dark that had once been so bright. Then, hungry and tired, lonely and cold, he cried, "Won't you show me your windows of gold?" Then a kind hand touched him and said, "Behold, high on the mountains are your windows of gold. For the sun going down in the great golden ball were burnishing the windows of his cabin so small. And the kingdom of God with his great shining light, like the golden windows that had shone so bright, is not a far distance place somewhere. It's as close to you as a silent prayer. And your search for God will end and begin when you look for him and find him within." May God, as I understand him, wrap his arms around all of you here and keep you safe in sobriety. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Harry, for sharing your early AA experiences with us. I'm always comforted when I have speakers precede me who mention important names in AA. I've been around so long that it's almost invariable I have to mention them as well. And I'm a little bit diffident about that because it sounds as though I may be treading in areas where I don't belong. But as Harry has mentioned those names, I may refer to them as well myself because it is a fact of my AA association, and you will permit me to do it. So often when I reflect on AA, my mind comes to trustees with whom I served. It's quite natural because that's where I was most present in what I did for AA. I was a trustee, and I knew many of the trustees, some of the early ones. At the present time, there are 21 trustees of the General Service Board. 14 of them are alcoholics, and 7 non-alcoholics. It was not always so. In the beginning, that is to say in 1938, there were 5 trustees. 3 of them were non-alcoholics and 2 alcoholics. They were appointed under an instrument called an indenture of trust. An indenture of trust. We were not always a corporation. They replaced the indenture of trust with a corporation called the Alcoholic Foundation, and now the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first and only chairman of Alcoholics Anonymous was an alcoholic. He lasted only a year, and it was not his fault. AA discovered that the chairman, in the discharge of his responsibilities, was from time to time required to disclose who he was by name. And the early alcoholics, Bill among others, learned that you were not supposed to give your last name no matter what the circumstances were. And at that point, they thought it was prudent to have the chairman thereafter become non-alcoholics because they could tell whomever they wanted to, who they were, and no offense would occur to the fellowship. The first lady who became a trustee was named Margaret Ferrand. She was a non-alcoholic who served from 1941 to 1944. I couldn't find out very much about her. I consulted the archives, and the best that I could do was to find out that she was a housewife and a community leader. That now brings me to our next speaker, a lady, a trustee who served about the time I came around. Our next speaker is Margaret C. She was elected to the trustees in 1973. She served until 1977. She joined AA in 1959, and she now lives in Vero Beach in Florida. She is a devoted servant of AA and a most gracious lady. Please welcome Margaret C.
Hi, everyone. My name is Margaret, and I am an alcoholic. I'm a member of the original Springfield group in Springfield, Massachusetts. And this was not just the first group in Springfield. It was also the very first group to take root in the entire western part of the state of Massachusetts. And it has been carrying the message, its message, to the alcoholic who still suffers, for it's in its 62nd year. I think that is just mind-boggling. And that group was there for me when I was ready to throw in the towel on February 2nd of 1959, and the group is there for me today. And I can get pretty emotional thinking about the beginning of that group, because the very, very first meeting was held in a hotel lobby. A little handful of people, five or six people, sat together in that lobby to help each other to stay sober. They hadn't any place else to meet. And it takes me back to the beginnings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I always connect the two with Bill pacing up and down in that hotel lobby in Akron, Ohio, lonely, late Saturday afternoon. His business deal's fallen through. He hasn't got any money. And he hears the tinkling of the glasses in the bar room next door and the laughter. And then he has that moment of insight that tells him he has to find another alcoholic to talk to, not just to help that person, but to help himself to stay sober. And thus began the chain that spread from city to city, to Springfield, that lobby in Springfield, Massachusetts, all around the world, that chain of Alcoholics Anonymous that you and I are part of, and the chain that we experienced and we felt last night when all those flags came into that convention center. What a mountaintop experience. What a gift we have. When AA was beginning, I was living in an alcoholic home. My mother was a very far advanced, fallen down alcoholic, and this was in the days when ladies were supposed to drink like ladies, and they couldn't even sit on a stool at a bar. And that to be drunk in public, and my mother was drunk in public many times, was a crime, punishable by law. My father was also an alcoholic, and his alcoholism was far less visible, but far more damaging to the family, and particularly to me. And the pain I lived in was so great, and the fear that eventually became terror, that I came to the point where I wanted to do away with myself. And I can remember sitting on a number of occasions in my third floor bedroom window, just trying to get the courage to drop down to the pavement three floors below. And I couldn't get the courage. So I pulled that shell around me that we alcoholics so often do when we can't stand the pain. And of course, if I couldn't stand the pain and I couldn't feel the pain with this ironclad shell around me, I also couldn't feel the good things that happened in life. And I just went along, just plodded along, and finally was able to leave that home and take an 11-hour train trip to school, to college in Rochester, New York, where Dr. Jack Norris, one of our wonderful non-alcoholic trustees who served for so very many years, worked as in the medical department of Eastman Kodak. And I remember thinking, well, maybe I can begin to live. But immediately I came in contact with a group of heavy drinking students. And I have to say to you that from the first drink, I drank alcoholically. I never had one drink without that drink calling for the next one and the next one. And I would continue to drink until society on that day put a stop to the drinking through the closing of the bar or the school curfews. We had curfews in those days in school. And I would get on that merry-go-round of alcoholism. Now, I had my first contact with Alcoholics Anonymous while I was still there in college. One morning, and it was an 8 a.m. class, which I didn't usually grace with my presence, but one morning, three gentlemen, this was early in 1943, three gentlemen from this new organization, this organization was only 7.5 years old at that time, this new AA came to speak to the class, to my sociology class, and I'll never forget what they looked like. They came in and they had on their suits or their jackets and their ties, and I want to tell. And they shared that early in AA's history. They shared. They did public information work, and I remember being so impressed. And I thought, oh, that would be perfect for my mother. I left college, finally finished, and went great, got into the workplace and moved from job to job, and finally ended up in Springfield, Massachusetts. And there I found myself a husband, thinking that if I changed things around me, I would be better, my drinking would be better. But, of course, that didn't work. And he went to church on a regular basis. And so I would go with him, and I was sat in that pew in church, hungover and reeking of alcohol, I'm sure. And one morning, the pastor announced that they were looking for homes for five children who had been taken away from alcoholic parents by the courts. And a flashbulb went off in my mind. I thought, oh, if I have a child, everything will be all right. And so we volunteered to take one of the children. And about 3 weeks before Christmas, a little three-year-old girl was brought to our door, and they had told me, don't buy anything. She'll bring her clothes and her belongings. And she carried a brown grocery paper bag, and that was her total belongings. And as I unpacked that night, looking for something to put her to bed in, I pulled out a nightie, a little infant's nightie that had been allowed to stretch with her body. And I said to my husband, isn't it terrible that anyone would treat a little girl like this? And yet the things that I did to her in the next few years were first far worse than putting her in a nightie with holes in it. Time went on. I tried to love her, but I didn't have any love to give. I tried to hold her, and I couldn't sustain the emotion. And then finally, a few years later, this little girl became my bottom, the bottom below which I never want to go. She is my defense against the first drink. And we need a defense against the first drink, because I never want to go back to those days. A couple of years later, she was ready to go to school, and I used to have to comb and brush. She had a ponytail by now, and I used to have to comb and brush it. And I would do that, and alcoholism had given me more symptoms, and one of them was that I could strike out. I wanted to strike out at people, even if you brought me a bouquet of flowers, I might want to hit you. And that urge, as I comb and brushed my little girl's ponytail, that urge to strike out would come over me. And I would push her away because I didn't want to hurt her. And then on one morning, a loving God decided I had become teachable. And I had that moment that said, it isn't my little girl. It wasn't my parents. It was alcohol that was doing this to me. And God placed sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous directly in my path. And they attracted me into this fellowship. And I am so grateful. When I walked through the doors of the Springfield group, and it was a smaller, much smaller, small group at that point, hands reached out to me. And they not only gave me, and that was on February 2nd of 1959, and they not only gave me their telephone number, they took my telephone number, and they used my telephone number. They knew that I had to learn to live sober. And they began to give me this gift of living one day without one drink. And they were pretty tough in those days. Any idiot can stay sober for one day, they used to say. All you have to do is say please in the morning and thank you at night. And they were tough taskmasters. They led me into the kitchen and they handed me a dish towel, because we didn't have styrofoam cups in those days. We had to use the church crockery. And I began to get a little sober. AA gave me a sponsor, a wonderful man. He was a janitor in a number of apartment blocks. And he said to me early on, he said, Margaret, the first thing you do in the morning is you thank God for the gift of life. And I thought to myself, really, I wasn't on very good terms with God. But, you know, I wanted what you people had. And so I would, my bed was right next to a window, so I would stand in that window and I'd say, thank you, God, for the gift of life today. Help me not to pick up a drink today. You know, but the thing is, I said the words. We have to say the words before we can feel them. And a couple weeks later, all of a sudden one day a tickle went up the back of my spine. And I began to realize that it was pretty good waking up and not having to run to the bathroom to throw up. And I began to get physically sober in this program. And they began to teach me how to do 12-step work. You know, we didn't have any treatment programs in those days. We did 12-step work. We carried this message into, and they taught me right away, you know. And I the first call I had was in a, went with on, was in a drunken boarding house, and drunks were coming out of the woodwork, and I was terrified. But, you know, it worked. And we used to have to sit with people while they withdrew from alcohol. That's how people got sober in those days. The AA member would sit with them and hold their hand while they withdrew from alcohol. And we would do it in shifts. And they were wonderful, wonderful days. And I am so grateful I was part of that point in time in AA history. My sponsor, you know, we have awakenings and reawakenings, and one of my major ones was the day that I went to pick up a woman to play golf, and she lived in my sponsor's apartment block. And, of course, he was Janet today, and he's ambling up the street in his work clothes and his holy dungarees, or sneakers, rather, and dungarees. And, you know, on that day, I was ashamed of him. I looked at him, and all of a sudden, he's whistling away. He was short and stocky, and I looked at him, and all of a sudden, all the false pride came over me, and I was ashamed of him. I picked the woman up. We drove away. We came back late in that afternoon. Now, I want to tell you, I did not see the golf ball that day, but I surely saw Margaret. That wall around me cracked away, you see, because I finally began to be able to trust another human being and maybe even care a little bit about another human being. And I saw myself. And I drove her back to that apartment block, and she, my sponsor, had been placed by God in exactly the same spot he was in that morning, ambling up the street, whistling away. And I jumped out of the car, and I ran up to him, and I, you know, made a big deal of him. And he never mentioned that episode to me, and I never mentioned it to him. But he knew that I knew that he knew. And I knew that he knew that I knew. And on that day, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and began to walk the journey of these 12 steps, the journey I walk today. And life has become just wonderful. In 1970, my area sent me to the General Service Conference in New York as its delegate. And we sat on Sunday night, the opening dinner of the conference. And Bill Wilson always opened that dinner. And as he got up to speak that night, he began to... Now, we knew he was sick, but we didn't realize how sick he was. And as he got up to speak that night, he couldn't get his breath. And he started coughing. And he would try again to talk. And, you know, the pain in that room was palpable. And I think at that point I realized the important time in AA history that we were living. And then in July of that year, we had our international convention in Miami, Florida. And again, Bill was supposed to open that convention on Friday night. And of course, he couldn't be there. He was too sick. He was in a hospital. And Mike Alexander's partner, Bernard Smith, one of our architectures of Alcoholics Anonymous, architects of Alcoholics Anonymous, took his place and gave a wonderful talk. But, of course, everybody missed this, Bill. And then rumor had it, as the convention went on, that maybe we would see him on Sunday morning, that they were going to try to get him to the convention hall. Now, the theme of that convention had been the first tradition. Our common welfare should come first. Because personal recovery depends upon AA unity. And they had taken that one word, unity, and they had it on a big banner, huge letters with that one word, unity. And we had emblazoned on it, and we'd been looking at that all weekend. And as they pushed Bill onto the stage that morning in his wheelchair with this big tank of oxygen beside him, in his orange blazer. It was in the citrus state of Florida, of course. So he had this bright orange state. And as he pulled himself up to his full Vermont height, the place just went wild. People were cheering and applauding and crying. And through the blur of my tears, Bill and that one word, unity, just came right together so that they were one. And at that moment in time, I had the awakening that lives in my heart today, because I suddenly felt the gift that had been given to us by our founders, Bill and Dr. Bob, by the early AAs, by all our non-alcoholic friends who had laid such a solid foundation for us. And it's my prayer today that each of us will hold this legacy carefully, safely, keeping it safe, not diluting it or changing it, so that it will be here and we can pass it to all the alcoholics who shall follow us.
Thank you, Margaret. Thank you so much for sharing your views and experiences as an early trustee of AA and indeed a pioneer. I'm so pleased to be sharing the podium today with three alcoholics who have been around a long time and know AA and know it very well. They mention names that when I am asked to speak, I have to in some way or other mention without appearing to advance my own position in life. You have to say who they are. They've said it. I may say it. So it's because they said it that I say it. Harry handed me a note to say that he forgot to tell them how Bill W. urged each of us, and this is a quotation, to guard the traditions very well as a society, because if we don't, we would no longer survive for any length of time. And I've just mentioned it, Harry. I hope that's acceptable. And thank you, Margaret, for your very welcome remarks. George D. is our final speaker. He grew up in the Midwest, lived in California for a time, and now makes his home in New York. I know George very well. We argue a lot. It always upsets him when people who do not know us invariably think that I am the alcoholic and he is a non-alcoholic. I say to him, George, notwithstanding the many meetings which you attend and the great stories that you hear about anonymity and modesty, that I am just as spiritual as you are, and maybe more so. He doesn't accept that, and I'm going to let him explain it to you. George?
Well, my name is George, and I'm an alcoholic. And for Mike's benefit, I'm a drunk. Or as a lady said in Wales, I just love the expression. She wasn't sober at the meeting, but she was Margaret and she was a drunkard. I like that word, drunkard. But I said that for Mike's benefit because 20 years or so ago, I had rotated as trustee on the board. But I was having lunch with Mike and Bud Flanagan, who some of you may have heard of. He was our auditor since I think we had an annual budget of about $75,000, the General Service Office, and he loved AA, and he was sort of proprietary about it, as is Mike. Some of our non-alcoholic friends become that way. And we were talking, and I just said something about being a drunk. And both Bud and Mike immediately spoke up and said, "That's the trouble with AA today. You don't have enough drunks." Too many alcoholics, not enough drunks. Well, I'm a legitimate drunk, but it's really an honor to be on this panel with Harry. I don't remember you from L.A. days, and you probably don't remember me, but we've talked and corresponded in recent years about AA history and Margaret. I've known Margaret and Mike from about the same week 30 years ago when I showed up as a delegate at the General Service Conference. Margaret, at that time, was our only woman trustee out of 21 trustees, and she was beautiful and eloquent and elegant as she is today. And Mike was a brand new Class A trustee, and in the finance committee meeting, I was a young, he was eyeing me and I was eyeing him, and he was a smart Wall Street lawyer, and I was a rebel without a cause, or as a friend of mine says, "You're a rebel without a pause." We have been sharing, shall we say, ever since. But it's really it's such a pleasure to be with the three of you. After over 30 years of never becoming involved in organized religion, I joined a large and historic church in New York about 12 years ago. And one thing led to another, and I wound up as president of the board. And the church has a 180-year-old custom where on the last Sunday in January, the ministers have to sit in the congregation, and the board puts on the service, and the outgoing president gives the sermon. So I really prepared for this. I wrote it out, and I practiced, and I developed ministerial cadences in the talk, and it was well received, and I went on a total ego trip, and I figured I could afford it because it was the one and only opportunity that I would have in my long life to deliver a sermon under these circumstances. But I have, for many, many years, tried to really avoid any kind of behavior of that sort when I talk to the people in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope I'm doing all right. You never know. You know, humility is, you never know when you have it. I have a good idea when I don't have it, but I don't know. And I have help in being reminded that I don't have humility. But I have no idea when, if ever, I have any humility. Margaret and I were talking that, what are we doing on a pioneers panel? We're not pioneers. We've been around a while, but the pioneers came before us. We knew the pioneers, but we don't really qualify as pioneers. My last drink was in 1961, but it was exactly, I think, 50 years ago today that I bailed myself out of Lincoln Heights Jail in Los Angeles. I was 1955. And I'd been 12 steps by, not through public information, but by a drinking buddy of mine who was drunk when he 12 stepped me. But he told me about this big book, so I got out of jail and went down to the central office in L.A. and bought the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was a second edition. It had just come out. If I'd gotten there 3 or 4 months earlier, I'd have my own first edition. You know, speaking of humility, the den mother of my home group, Dorothy, is sitting in the front row, so I have to say a little bit honest, and Dorothy owes me $5 because I mentioned her name. And, you know, I start going to meetings immediately after reading the book 3 times so that I would could converse intelligently with all of you at my first or second AA meeting about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And people were coming back from St. Louis talking about what had happened there, AA coming of age, the adoption of the conference and all these things, and I didn't have a clue as to what they were talking about. But that was all 50 years ago, and I don't know where they've gone. How did I get there? You know, I can't get up and talk without telling at least one silly drinking story. So, Margaret mentioned golf, and I've had my Finnish AA brother here in New York last week, and we played some golf, so I'll tell my golf story. It was very near the end of my drinking. And I was in AA, but I wasn't sober. And I had made a date to play golf with some sober buddies of mine. And then gone on a bender, which had lasted a week or so. Forgot about the golf date. They stopped by on Sunday morning to pick me up. And, you know, we were a little more relaxed about alcoholics drinking and those AA members drinking. But they picked me up, and I managed to throw a bottle of pint of gin in my golf bag and for medicine, and we went out to Griffith Park Golf Course in Los Angeles, and that's an enormous plant, you know, but we started out, it was very hot, and that golf course is situated in a spot that is a, sort of a, was a fog center, smog center, air was very bad, and I kept taking a few pulls on the bottle when I thought no one was looking and began to deteriorate seriously. And Mike and I played golf a lot, and he knows that I can play the game, but about the sixth hole, I'm whiffing the ball and having trouble in general. And the crisis came when I leaned over to tee up the ball for my drive and kept going and landed right on my nose, at which point my buddies suggested that I return to the clubhouse and wait for them, and they'd take me home afterwards, so I headed off. And we had little pull carts in those days, not the electric carts. Griffith Park is a huge complex. There's two 36-hole golf courses and an executive course. And it's right next to the Griffith Park Zoo. And so I headed off, and I was having trouble. I couldn't find the clubhouse. And I played the course a lot, but I couldn't find the clubhouse. So I'm pulling my cart through the smog, you know, and foursomes would come by me, and balls would whiz over my head, and people would yell, four. And I'm very confused. And then I saw this remarkable sight. An elephant had escaped from the Griffith Park Zoo. And I was really concerned about it. That I'd damaged the greens and the trap, and here's an escaped elephant. The zoo's right next door. And so I thought, I've got to go in and find the clubhouse and tell them there's an escaped elephant out on the golf course. And finally I saw the clubhouse. Well, I kept trying to follow the elephant, but he'd be there, and then he'd kind of go, and I'd get to within about a 9-iron of him, and suddenly he'd be over there. So I'm kind of zigzagging around the course trying to get near this elephant. And then I saw the clubhouse, and I went in, and I had a little second thought before I went in the pro shop and sat down on a chair outside the pro shop, and the next thing I remember, my buddies picked me up to take me home. You know, I attributed that to heat stroke for a very long time. You know, I want to talk about some other things, so I really don't want to get into my drunk log at any extent, other than, like Margaret, I came from an alcoholic family, but I knew that all the problems were from alcohol, and I was a 10-year-old saloon buster. I wanted to throw bricks through liquor store windows and take a baseball bat on the bottles in the back of my mother's bar. But then I became a teenager, which was horrible, and I was so lonely and so isolated and so confused that I had the obsession to drink before I took my first drink. I felt somehow, maybe when I could drink, things would somehow be different, be a little better. And, of course, it worked. And I was an alcoholic from the very beginning. And in 1955 in Lincoln Heights Jail, I had a moment of clarity where I realized that all my ambition and all the hard work that I would do, all my efforts to be a contender were just a waste of time, that I was going to go down the tubes on any one of these given drunks. And that's what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to talk about it took me 6 years on and off to find sobriety for a very simple reason. I put conditions on sobriety. In New York AA, we talk about we're looking for the cash and prizes. And I kept looking for the cash and prizes. And the longer I'd stay sober, the bigger the cash and prizes were supposed to be. And when they didn't come along, I would simply get drunk. And in the end, I had the final moment of clarity. I forgot the promises. We didn't read them in those days anyway. Had to wipe off all the conditions on staying sober. I decided that I would try to stay sober, to stay alive, and that the only promise that I could make out of not taking the first drink was that I would die eventually of something other than alcoholism. And from there on, I'm a very ordinary guy, but I've had a very extraordinary life in just about every department. And at times, you know, I sound irreverent, and I may get a little irreverent as I go, but that's because, as people in this room, some of whom I know and love very much, know, I absolutely and totally revere Alcoholics Anonymous. And it has been the foundation for my entire life, and it's the base from which I've gone out and tried to do everything else in every department of my life. But, you know, now I'm going to get on to the AAA I just want to talk about the Long Beach Convention, which I attended. My sponsor had been a delegate to Panel 9, I think, and was friendly with Bill, and I was kind of having trouble on the program, so he arranged for me to meet Bill. And Bill gave me about 5 minutes, and there was a laying on of the hands, literally, you know, so now I can stay sober. Unfortunately, 2 months later, I was drunk in the San Pedro jail. And Jules, my sponsor, was kind of disgusted. He said, I give up on you. Even Bill can't sober you. But he didn't give up on me, really, you know. But, you know, what I remember about that convention was the irreverence with which we treated Bill. He was being continuously kidded from the podium, and on Saturday night they had a show with great entertainment from friends of AA, such as Peggy Lee and so forth, but they did one skit where they had blackouts, and it was Bill's sponsees, and I remember three of them. The first one was Bill's first sponsee, and the lights come on, and it was Buster Keaton dressed as Abraham Lincoln. The second was Bill doesn't always have too much luck with his sponsees, and the lights came on, and it was a chimpanzee. It was the only paid entertainer at that, and he was jumping around up and down like chimpanzees do, waving a bottle. And the third one that I remember and most memorable was where the basis for AA's tradition of men not making 12-step calls on women or sponsoring women, and the lights came on, and there was Jay Mansfield, an early movie star, in all her glory of 8 months of pregnancy. And, you know, this was Bill. And we all laughed, and Bill howls with laughter. So this was the way it was. My first group was a young people's group, and I remember it was my second meeting. I walked in, I wasn't really welcomed, but after the meeting, they just told me to sit down and see if there was anything I could use. Didn't ask me many questions, but after the meeting, they talked about what they were going to do. They didn't invite me, but I had this distinct sense that I was instantly included. So I went with them, and that was the way Alcoholics Anonymous was in those days. Just one more quick drinking story. We were a lot, you know, I went to AA meetings a lot during those first 6.5 years, sometimes sober, but not always sober. And nobody got too upset by my being there. I would try to be in some kind of shape where I could make it through the meeting and not cause a disturbance. And I'd always pick meetings with, like, the old Arlington group, which was a large room and not that many members, so I could sit apart from people a little bit so that they couldn't smell me. You know, I drank vodka, but so my breath was all right, but it was coming out of my pores. And, you know, AA in those days, I'm trying to give you a sense of it. There was a great guy, George Bardish. I'm going to break his last name, and he's deceased, of course. But we called him Bar Trash. And he was a blue-collar worker, a big, tough guy with a splayed nose. And he would see me, and he would just come over. I'd be isolated in the room as much as I could. But he would come over and sit maybe one chair away from me and not say a word. But I could feel the understanding and the sympathy and the warmth of his presence, the comfort that he gave me just by walking over and sitting next to me. And that's the way things were. And we were very tolerant of, I said, we understood that the name of the game was Alcoholics Anonymous, not Sobriety Anonymous. And my sponsor and some of his friends had a poker game 25-30 Saturday nights a year, and I was always invited. And they hoped I would show up sober, but it wasn't mandatory. And on one occasion, I showed up, and I had a bottle in the car, and we played poker for a while. And I said, well, I got to go out and get a cigar. So I go out the car and take a few pulls in the bottle and go back in. It was raining like hell. And then I'd play poker for a while, and now I got to get some pipe tobacco. So I had all these excuses to go out to the car. And by the third or fourth trip, I was so wet, the seat was wet underneath me. And at one point, Nona, my sponsor's wife, said, Jules, why don't you tell George to bring the bottle in and put it on the sink? We don't care. He's going to catch pneumonia this way. And Jules was very wise and understood me very well. Says, no, no, George is happier this way. So if you want me, I've got to get the things. One more thing about the way AA was. I just want to say that I hear all these people, some of whom were not, haven't been around nearly as long as I do, talk about the way AA was in the old days. And I have, you know, you think there's this tough outfit with these mean sponsors and all sorts. I don't remember that. In all honesty, I do not remember that. I've heard about the School of Los Angeles tough sponsors. But I don't remember them. My sponsor was one of them. But he barked, but it was just a bark. He had no bite at all. There was tenderness and understanding and compassion and love. And nobody poked their finger in my chest telling me what I had to do. Nobody hit me over the big book. There were no authorities. We shared what we thought and what we were doing as peers, as equal. Nobody was trying to teach anybody anything. And that was the Alcoholics Anonymous that I remember. I guess there's a lot of people who have different memories, but I am trying to be as honest with you as I can about what AA used to be like in Southern California in the early, in the mid, late 50s and the early 60s when I left. One thing I was going to read. This is the way AA used to be. You know, you think we did everything perfectly. This was a letter written on December 5th, 1941. To Irma L., I'll preserve her anonymity. At a meeting of the Executive Committee to the Los Angeles Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, held December 4th, 1941, it was decided that your attendance at group meetings was no longer desired until certain explanations and plans for the future were made to the satisfaction of this committee. This action has been taken for reasons which should be most apparent to you. I showed this letter to John Grant, former staff member. He said, boy, that Irma must have been some cookie. It was decided that should you so desire, you may appear before members of this committee and state your attitude. This opportunity will be afforded you between now and December 15, 1941. You may communicate with us at the above address by that day. In case you do not wish to appear, we shall consider the matter closed and you will be terminated. So Mike is tugging at me. I've got to get on. People ask me and just ask my sponsor, has AA changed? And I don't think not much, not really. I mean, do you hear different language in a sense coming out of treatment facilities and so forth? But if you think about what they're saying, they're not talking about anything so much different than we talked about 40 or 50 years ago. They're just found, and I'm not all that comfortable with the language. No, I can't be a bleeding deacon anymore. I'm on a blood thinner, and it might be dangerous dangerous to my health. And I'm going to have to wind up, but I want to read at least one more little item. And I thought about it during this convention. It was something written by Dr. Jelinek, who was one of AA's very early and most important friends in the profession. I think about it when we come here and carry on. He says, and it was prepared for the souvenir book of the 1960 AA convention, which I still have. If there is a danger in the present and the future, the peril comes from another aspect. As the alcoholic goes through the painful process of achieving humility, he unloads his personal grandiosity and pride upon the group. As time goes by, a tremendous load of pride and grandiosity could accumulate on the shoulders of this splendid fellowship. And it could lead to feelings of omniscience and omnipotence. I think that's something to think about. I have great faith in the future of AA. Other things that concern me, of course, that I worry about, but over the long haul, the bottom, the end of the line, they don't concern me too much. I think we have to be careful that we don't become too fearful. As institutions mature, they tend to be too protective of the institution at the expense of the mission of the institution itself. I don't think that Alcoholics Anonymous has anything to fear from anybody, either in or outside of the rooms, if we focus on why we are here, which is to carry the message. And now, Mike, I'm going to try to wind this up. This is a pioneers meeting, but Bill talked at Long Beach, the famous long talk, an hour and 45 minutes. And all he got to after an hour and 45 minutes is when Dr. Bob and he went out to see Bill D, AA number 3. It took him an hour and 45 minutes to get there. I'm doing better than that. But the way he closed, he said, and from here on, there's nothing, it's the same story. It's just two drunks calling on another. There's nothing new. There's nothing historic about this. So in a sense, everybody in this room is a pioneer today if you simply do what we've always been doing, which is go talk to a drunk. That's, you know, we, in those old days, we didn't worry about who was sitting in the rooms and whether they belonged there. We worried about the guys who belonged there but weren't there. And I think that spirit still prevails, particularly in the 79th Street workshop, which has 56 meetings a week in New York. And I think that we can all be pioneers, and to sum it up very simply, in the words of another pioneer, in fact, the founder, one more thing. None of us would be here today if somebody hadn't taken time to try to explain things to us, to lend us a friendly ear, to take us to a meeting or two, to give us a little pat on the back. So let us never get such a degree of smug complacency that we're not willing to extend or attempt to extend that help, which has been so freely given to all of us. Thanks very much.
Thank you, George. My wife bet me that as chairman of chairing this session with three old-timers, we would not finish on time. She was right, but we're very close. Let me just say a couple of things about the pioneer aspect of the fellowship. Dr. Bob was a trustee for 6 years, 1938 on the first board to 1944. Bill W. was a trustee for only 2 years, 1949 to 1951. Currently, trustees are limited to a term of 4 years, that is, alcoholic trustees. Non-alcoholics may serve for 6 years and no more. At the beginning, I guess non-alcoholics, were in relatively short supply in AA, so they were permitted to serve for an almost unlimited time. And some of them did, which is an enormous surprise to me, because it is not consistent with the experience that I have with other so-called nonprofit corporations. Dr. Jack Norris, whose name was mentioned, was a trustee for 27 years, a non-alcoholic, 27 years. In 17 of them, he was chairman of the board. Bernard Smith was a trustee for 26 years, one less than Dr. Norris. He was chairman of the board for, I think, 6 or 8 years. Following him, Leonard Harrison was a trustee, also a non-alcoholic, was a trustee for 22 years, I believe, and after that it was Archibald Roosevelt, was a trustee for 16 years. That's remarkable to me. Trustees who are not paid and serve on nonprofit organizations do not stick around that long, but they did in AA, which teaches me, including me incidentally, which teaches me AA imparts some influence on us, which we are generally aware when we come on board. But somewhere along the line, we decide that it is important for us to continue because it is a task that we would profit, or society would profit, from our assuming and discharging. And as George just said at the tail end of his remarks, in a sense, now that we're speaking of pioneers, we are all pioneers of AA. All of us, each one here in this room. I say that insofar as the future is concerned, because we will affect the future of AA in what we do now. We have a legacy to carry forward, and how we carry that legacy on after us is how the fellowship will be affected. I can tell you, and certainly my friends here on this panel can tell you, that AA is as different today as the society which it serves. Things are not the same in 2005 as they were when I first became aware and associated with AA in some form nearly 55 years ago. We live in a different climate, and we have to behave in a different way to attract societies in which we live. That long time ago, I joined Bernard Smith's law firm. He was a corporate lawyer. It was a corporate practice. He introduced me to Bill W., and I think it is fair to say that Bill introduced me to AA. Bill W. and Bernard Smith were then involved in trying to put together what was established as the Alcoholics Anonymous Conference in 1950, and which was going to become a permanent fixture in AA together with the charter. When I saw those two men working on something which was beyond my comprehension at the time, I had a sense that they were doing something that was quite unusual. Certainly it was unusual in terms of what else I was acquainted with in the law firm. AA was a nonprofit organization of very, very, very curious proportions to me. It appeared to be put together for a noble purpose. It had no money to speak of. But it wouldn't take money from the general public. That was quite unusual in terms of what a nonprofit organization those days called a charitable organization would do. It had members who for themselves decided whether they were going to be members or not. They didn't pay any dues. They didn't register. They could cease to be members whenever it chose them to reach that conclusion. And I was obliged to look at this and try to make some sense of it in my own view. It was not easy. I have to tell you, I don't have to tell you, but I will tell you, that I am not an alcoholic. No member of my family is an alcoholic. My wife is not an alcoholic. No member of her family is an alcoholic. It has seemed to me that destiny had to work very, very hard to bring AA and me together. But it has. It has. And for that, I am deeply grateful. I don't know of any organization which is self-satisfying for people to be associated with who do not get, in terms of what is involved, a direct benefit from it. But there certainly is a very indirect benefit that comes from it. I am a different person because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe a far better one than I would have been. I thank you, and I thank Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thank God for all it has done for all of us. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. And I'll see you at the next convention.